For my next trick, I, the great Wolfengrim, will cause a dragon to appear on stage. Dragonomico!
Hi.
What are you doing here?
I'm a dragon.
I know you're a dragon. You're a real dragon. Where's the big plaster dragon I use in this trick?
I think I might have eaten it. It looked like Wastonicus.
It took me forever to make that. What's Wastonicus?
It's something dragons eat. It's kind of like tofu. We also call it mock dragon.
Okay, how do I send you back to wherever you came from?
I don't know why you're asking me. I thought you were a magician.
I am, but I don't... I'm getting such a headache from this right now. Look, how about if I just give you some bus fare or something?
I don't think it works that way. How about if I sing to the audience? I do a medley from Cats and Evita.
No, I'm a magician. What do I need with a dragon who sings Andrew Lloyd Webber songs? Actually, hold on, that might be a winner. Do you really sing them?
Don't cry
for me. No, not now. We're going to take a short intermission, and when we come back, I'll have a special treat for you. Meanwhile, listen to the show about stage magic and magic. And now he pulls a rabbit out of his pants every morning. Colin McEnroe.
Thank you, although that doesn't sound good somehow. All right, so what are we talking about today? We're talking about a lot of things at once. You know, in the book World of Wonders, the Canadian novelist Robertson Davies invents a stage magician, Magnus Isengrim, who I think does the cleanest job of bridging the murky gap we'll be talking about today. That gap between magic and magic. By that I mean the gap between an inexplicable spectacle created for us through artistry and the deeper, darker sense of an inexplicable world fueled by esoteric knowledge and by things that refuse to conform to our notion of the rational. In his novel, Davies cites, of all people, the historian Oswald Spengler and his Decline of the West. Spengler writes about the Magian view of the world, by which he means the Persian and Semitic cultures that predate the rise of modern civilization. And indeed, the word magic probably comes from the same place as those magi we see bearing gifts in Christmas pageants. Spengler said the Magian culture was defeated once and for all at the Battle of Actium. That's a whole other story. If Mark Antony had won, I don't know, maybe we'd all be Persian. I'm not quite sure, but we'd be Egyptian. Anyway, but for Robertson Davies and his character Isengrim, the battle continued to rage and is a contest between bloodless rationalism and the older mindset. And here's how one of the other characters in the book describes that older mindset. It was a sense of the unfathomable wonder of the invisible world that existed side by side with a hard recognition of the roughness and cruelty and day-to-day demands of the tangible world. It was a readiness to see demons where nowadays we see neuroses, and to see the hand of a guardian angel and what we are apt to shrug off ungratefully as a stroke of luck. It was religion, but a religion with 1,000 gods, none of them all-powerful and most of them ambiguous in their attitudes towards men. When we watch a great magician, this is me now, when we watch a great magician, we're feasting on the same food that gets served in a Harry Potter novel, the notion of a double world, a universe of things we can't see. Now, some have gone a little bit further and said that the modern hierarchy, which puts science at the top, then religion, then magic, is just a social construction, that if somebody with a different pedigree had laid out all the modern laws of quantum behavior 50 years before Einstein, we would have called that magic. Anyway, that's one argument for why we love all kinds of magic so much, because we're reaching back to touch a set of lost sensibilities that we never really let go of. Today we're going to talk to a magician who actually does stage magic, but also does it to teach about sustainability and in fact, to sort of invoke certain kinds of scientific ideas, suggesting that magic and science are not always at war with one another. We're also going to talk to Lev Grossman. He's the book critic for Time Magazine. You've heard him on our show many times. He's the author of several award-winning books, including The Magician, The Magician King, and coming up, The Magician's Land, the third book in the trilogy. We'll also talk to Lawrence Haas. He's a professor of humanities at Austin College, associate dean of Jeff McBride's Magic and Mystery School in Las Vegas, and publisher of Theory and Art of Magic Press. And then later in the show, we're going to talk to two neuroscientists who study what our brains do when we watch magic, when we watch stage magic, what actually is being done to fool our brains. A lot of intersection of science and magic. But we're going to begin with a conversation about why, in fact, magic fascinates us. And it does fascinate us in both of the ways that we're talking about right now. Obviously, led by Harry Potter and books like Lev's book and a whole range of other products, we've seen – products is the wrong word – but we've seen this incredible renaissance of magic in fantasy. But we've also seen a real interest in magic, sort of stage magic, whether it's through artists like Penn and Teller or a whole bunch of movies, The Prestige, The Illusionist, maybe some movies that magicians would like to forget, like The Incredible Burt Wonderstone. There's a reanimation of our interest in both of those things. And so, Lev, I'm going to start out with you. I'm going to stop babbling and start out with you. What happened? Describe this. I mean, you are part of this renaissance, and amusingly, your characters in your books, they're kind of like the Sopranos of magic, in the sense that the characters in the Sopranos are very aware of all the Scorsese films. Your characters are very aware, really, of this interest in magic, and they'll say, "Well, this I wish we could go into that tapestry the way they do in Harry Potter books."
One of the sort of central, I guess you could call it an innovation, or one of the good ideas I had was that the idea that people, if there were actually a secret school for magic, probably the people who went there would also be huge fantasy nerds and would always be comparing what was happening to them to, you know, Harry Potter and Narnia and whatever else they'd read.
And you, before we were getting ready to go here, you were sort of saying that you felt a little bit intimidated being on a show with people who actually know how to do magic or how magic is done. But first of all, do you think that there is an overlap between what you're writing about, which is a magical world in which magic things happen and which people learn how to perform magic? I mean, not magic as a trick exactly, but magic as a real phenomenon, and sort of what we see on stage when we're watching stage magic. Are those two completely segregated universes, or is there some commonality?
Well, I think at the root, and I think they come from the same root, they express a certain kind of longing, which is very common in modern life. As a writer of fantasy, I think of myself as descended from earlier writers like J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. And when you look at them, these are guys who lived through all of the kind of cataclysms that gave birth to the modern era. They were both veterans of the Somme. They lived through industrialization, the birth of mass media, the electrification of cities, the replacement of bicycles and of horses by bicycles and cars. These were people who felt as if modernity had alienated them from the world. It had separated from the world. It put them in a world they didn't understand, and they kind of longed for a world where things worked differently and where they felt more connected to the world, and the world was animated by a kind of living, wonderful, wondrous spirit. And I think they longed for that, and I think we do too, just as strongly. We've lived through huge technological transformations, which, if anything, have put us even farther away from the organic world around us. And we long for a way to get connected to that world and feel connected to it. And I think one of those ways is magic.
I mean, it seems to me also your characters have lived through kind of a different revolution, a digital revolution, and accompanying that digital revolution, a kind of whole kind of dry arch hipster culture that's kind of rejecting of any profundities. And so they're kind of at war in the books too, right? They know why everything is a joke because they hung around Brooklyn enough to kind of figure that out. On the other hand, they have a real yearning for and are frequently confronted by the fact that not everything is a joke. There's something considerably more than Pabst Blue Ribbon beer and fixed gear bicycles in the Lower East Side.
That's such an excellent point. And I think, you know, one of the things that drew me to fantasy, and the kind of magic, at least in books, is that the kind of magic that I loved was never funny. In order to cast a spell, in order to make something happen with your sort of mind and your feelings, you had to really mean it. You weren't kidding around. And there's something sort of wonderfully earnest about magic, where it's not a joke. It's a case where you're passionate about something and you're truly feeling it, and those feelings somehow get out of you and change things in the world around you. And I think one of the things the characters in the Magician's books do is they get in touch with that, with real feelings, powerful feelings that aren't ironized or otherwise, you know, stripped of their meaning.
This is a good time to bring in Cyril the Sorcerer, also known as C.J. May. He's a New Haven-based magician who uses magic, as I said, to teach about sustainability to both children and adults. And, but, you know, one of the things that I know that you've said in conversations with Betsy Kaplan as we got ready for this show is that in some of the ways that Lev just articulated, you think that in the sort of later 20th century, early 21st century, I don't know, was some of the artistry and earnestness kind of bled out of magic and replaced by just sort of a common sense of trickery?
I think so. Some well-respected magicians suggested that magicians in the 20th century did an amazing feat. They took an ancient, profound art and trivialized it to the point where it's just balloons and rabbits out of a hat. Now, neither of those tricks are bad in their own right, but magic and magicians used to be quite profound.
Explain, I mean, like, how profound in what way? I mean, I suppose, first of all, supposedly every magician from, you know, 1875 onwards labored under the shadow of Robert Houdin, right? I mean, is he sort of the guy who sort of gets this whole process going, this the kind of artistry that you're talking about?
I think so, but I think I'm not a history of Robert Houdin, but Houdini was. And I think he and Houdini intended to elevate magic and keep it respected and beloved by the population. But I think over the course of the 20th century, it has become quite simple to the point where it's generally made a joke of. You know, characters on television shows are seen as fools who pull rabbits out of hats and make idiots out of themselves, and in so doing, make idiots out of magicians. And we have, in a sense, done this to ourselves.
You're holding Job Bluth accountable for a lot of things right now, I think. I sense that.
I didn't mention any names.
All right. By the way, our number, if you want to chime in on this conversation, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You know, and significantly, two of the movies that I was talking about, The Illusionist and The Prestige, you know, I mean, they seem kind of centered, at least, I may not be locating both of them in the exact same time frame, but at least one of them is kind of located in the time that Lev is talking about, the time that slightly precedes some of those technological and scientific revolutions, where kind of, you know, that sort of lives in a time where you could maybe sit an audience in a beautiful theater and do magic in a way that called into question for them what they were actually seeing.
Yeah, indeed. And that was a pivotal time. Much of the magic of the Victorian era was because, actually, however, it was because of technology that things could be done that couldn't have been done before. And I think we're now seeing that real blurring of what is magic and what is technology. And frankly, is technology magic? And that really messes up the rice bowl, and you have to think about it more abstractly than you might have before.
You know, Lev, it seems as though one of the things we're saying is that, you know, whatever our relationship with magic is, and whether we're, you know, living in 1888 and sitting in a Victorian theater or reading one of your books in 2014, that in some ways we're rebelling against something, right? We're pushing back against something that, you know, that maybe the really great magicians of the early 20th century, maybe we're pushing back a little bit against technology. The writers that you talked about, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, kind of coming on and sort of insisting on a world of mystery at a time when mysteries were wanting to be solved. I mean, I guess magic, no matter how we're dealing with it, is kind of a counter-revolutionary movement.
Yes, but against what is slightly harder to say. One thing I always notice about my books is that a lot of my fans are engineers. A lot of them are software guys. You know, people who really understand technology and how it works, and yet they're drawn to this as well. I think. You know, one of the things that I find myself pushing back against is just, and it relates, of course, to technology, is being surrounded by things that that I don't understand and aren't connected to me. Like, for example, my iPhone. It was built and assembled in another country. It's sealed, so I can't get inside its workings and hack it. I don't know how it works or who made it. I feel utterly disconnected from it. One wants to kind of return to a world where that is comprehensible and that is somehow, you know, connected to oneself. And the technology that we are surrounded by and manipulated by definitely doesn't qualify in that respect.
And it does seem, just to go back to your earlier point too, that your characters are closer to us than many of the magical characters. I mean, I don't have that much in common with Gandalf, you know, and I really don't have that much in common with Harry Potter, although I think Rowling does attempt to create a group of plausible boys and girls who go through things that kind of resemble the maturation process that boys and girls go through. But they don't really talk like us. They don't really think like us. They don't use bad language the way we do, whereas your characters do. I mean, your characters seem very, very rooted in the moment and rooted in the sensibilities of the readers. I mean, I'm kind of surprised to hear that you say it's engineers and computer geeks and stuff like that reading your book, because it seems to me that people reading your books would sort of be people, well, could be anybody, but people of a certain age who are imbued with a certain sense of modern sensibilities.
Well, I'm a big Harry Potter fan and a big fan of J.K. Rowling. And I think one of the things I did in the Magician's books was just to try to sort of turn the screw of realism a few more turns, and really do a serious thought experiment. What would it be like if magic was real? What would happen if you put these powerful supernatural forces in the hands of adolescents and teenagers with all those strong feelings? And what sorts of horrible things would they do to each other? I even felt as though magic itself was in some ways kind of underdescribed in literature. I felt as though someone would cast a spell, you'd never hear somebody talking about, well, what does it sound like? What does it feel like in your fingertips as you cast a spell? What sort of smell does it leave in the air after it's gone? I just wanted to push harder on the question of what would it really be like? What would it feel like? What would magic be like if Hemingway described it, or Fitzgerald, or Virginia Woolf? I just wanted to push harder.
All right, we've got some interesting calls coming in here. Dan from Waterbury, we'll get to you in a second, but I want to bring on board Lawrence Haas. He's a professor of humanities at Austin College, associate dean of Jeff McBride's Magic and Mystery School in Las Vegas. First of all, maybe we should begin by just asking you, what's a nice professor like you doing in a place like this? What have your disciplines or your professorial inclinations got to do with the conversation we're having right now?
Well, thank you, first of all. It's a delight to be part of this conversation. My PhD is in philosophy, and the two areas of philosophy that I specialized in as a scholar were the study of experience and aesthetics. And I became fascinated in the aesthetic experience that magicians were creating on the stage. And now here, about 20 years later, my primary work is as a performing magician, and I travel creating magical experiences for people in all kinds of settings.
So it seems as though one of the common things that we're talking about right now is the notion of art. So it's art. It's an artistic experience when we watch a movie or read a book like one of Lev's books, in which they get us to believe or to enter at least the sensibilities of this magical world. But another kind of art is the art that you and Cyril are doing on stage, right? The creating of an artistic environment where we can have a different set of experiences and a different set of reactions. So talk to me about how you see magic as art.
Well, that's wonderful. That's the whole way I approach magic as an artist. And what that means for me specifically is that it is a form of performance, and performance is a form of theater. So magicians are performing artists who are creating a very special kind of theater. And in my view and my teaching of this, we are creating the theater of the impossible. We're creating a theatrical experience in which impossible things are brought to manifest in that space. And for me, the art of magic, magical artists are creating very intensive, very intentional experiences where the audience goes, no way. That's impossible. There's no way that could have happened.
But I feel like there's sort of a cultural prejudice against what you're saying. I mean, I subscribe to what you're saying, but I feel like there's a cultural prejudice against it. And I think that cultural prejudice is ages and ages and ages old. I mean, some of the reading I was doing for the show suggested you go back to Plato and find basically the same thing, that everything that's not canonical winds up being described as magic. So if it's not scientifically canonical, it's magic. If it's not religiously canonical, it's magic. If it's not artistically canonical, it's magic. I mean, magic, I do think, is often the object of a certain kind of prejudice, that this is all the stuff that we really don't embrace, either as art or as science or as religion. I mean, is that a fair thing to say, that that's something that you guys are warring against all the time? I'll let you start, Lawrence, but I want to hear Cyril on this, too.
Well, absolutely. For me, it's just a process of education. I think the reason that magic has gotten made the opposite of philosophy and the opposite of religion and the opposite of science is because people have failed to understand its nature as a theatrical art. Now, some magicians have contributed to that confusion, but many people just have not thought deeply enough, I think, about this particular kind of theater art. And I think once you understand the work that magicians do as a theatrical art form, suddenly it becomes much less alien and threatening, and it becomes the kind of thing that you might like to go enjoy on a Saturday night, just like you go to a movie.
Cyril the Sorcerer, also known as CJ May, I want you to react to that, too. I mean, I sense a prejudice, at least in some quarters, against magic, that somehow or other it isn't accorded the same status as a whole bunch of other things.
Well, I think if you're speaking about magic as a performance art as opposed to magic as something that one of Lev's characters may do or Harry Potter may do, I think you're right. I think that magicians are often disregarded, and I think that's too bad. Whereas I think you're right. In general, we talk about not performance. Oh, that's just a magic trick today. But in an ancient past, if you had something that you didn't understand, well, that was magic, and that was different. Notice the tone of my voice. It's quite different. And so I think one of the things that I've really enjoyed studying with Larry Haas, our other guest, is that he has a mission amongst many missions, and that's to help people value magic more differently than they used to, and to really show how powerful magic can be, and to elevate it back to a place where it's respected, because the magicians are not just performing tricks. They are performing magic, and there's a real difference to performing a trick than performing magic.
You know, Lev, he made a distinction between you and him, but I'm not sure that you would necessarily agree that that distinction exists, at least at the level of prejudice, right? Isn't there also, notwithstanding the incredible rise in popularity of the kind of literature that you're working in and the other authors that we've been talking about here, there is inevitably a ghettoization of that kind of writing, right?
There is actually fantasy does in the great hierarchy of literary genres with literary fiction at the top, fantasy is a perennial basement dweller, and it's not considered very respectable. It tends to be associated with children's literature and sort of infantile fantasies. People who can't deal with reality are the ones who read fantasy, which I think is quite wrong-headed.
You know, I'll just sort of chime in. I mean, the more that I read about this, the more I constructed my own probably unsupportable off-the-cuff theory that this is really a chronic condition, that everything that we're talking about really does go back to a few centuries B.C., and that, you know, as everything canonical developed, as a religious canon developed, as a scientific canon developed, magic actually, and you can sort of see it. I read some really interesting etymological studies of the word magic. Magic sort of became this way of parking a whole bunch of other stuff that didn't fit, whether it was Gnosticism or alchemy or just everything that didn't fit got parked in that category. And it was usually used as kind of a deviant word. Oh, yeah, that's magic. We don't take that as seriously as we take everything else. And I think it persists to today. But as I said in the introduction, what's odd about that is so many things that are real today, from your cell phone, Lev, that you don't know what's going on inside there and how it works, and you can't open it, and you're not really allowed to fathom it, to certainly quantum theory. You know, I mean, a lot of it is all stuff that wouldn't have fit at all into canonical theory early on. All right, I'm going to stop soapboxing here and go over to – we got a call from Dan in Waterbury. Hi, Dan.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Just fine.
I'm actually, my name is Daniel Greenwolf, and CJ is a friend of mine, and I heard that he was coming in today, and I thought that was awesome. And so I wanted to just make a mention, and because you mentioned about the idea of magic being seen as sometimes very trivial or often being seen with derision, and you know, there's a couple issues that go at play there. I mean, initially magic was a focal point to, especially performance magic, was a focal point to tribes and ancient pagan religions. And unfortunately, you know, as other religions came into power and they also used magic, they tried to kind of separate themselves. You know, it's just through the use of language. You know, they perform magic. We perform miracles. You know, they would do something like that. And so you already get this kind of leery look at magic from very early on, from hundreds of years ago, and before the Inquisition, and then, of course, during the Inquisition, you know, people who were seen as performing magic tricks or these magical things were said to be the work of the devil. And it would just kind of go on. And although magic has gotten, obviously, you know, with the discovery of witchcraft by Reginald Scott, which is really the first published magic book of note, you know, back in the 1700s, you've got this thing where people are are very much so, you know, they invite magic in and they love magic, but they're very leery of it because it does say at the base of it, I know something you don't, and people aren't always very trusting of that.
It's a great point, and it might be a great stopping point here so we can take a little break here. Thanks for your call, Dan. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about the clash and occasional intersection of magic and rational thought, I guess, is a good way to put it. We'll take a break. We'll come back.
Now you see him, now you can't. Yes, of course, you're vigilant, but you're up against the best. He'll have you looking east as he goes west. He's a magician, and you are not.
Okay, tell me I understand.
Stop! Why do you do that so fast?
Well, actually, you were too fast.
Really? Oh, I was too fast?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just not stopping where you want me to stop.
No.
Yeah.
No, really,
I think so. I think I got a little something here. You're stopping on the card. You know where the card is, and that's when I say stop. That's the trick, right?
No.
Is that the trick?
No. It's not. This is your card.
Okay. You listen to me, Superman. I want that trick.
No, can do. I apologize. I just can't do anything. You're not a magician.
You're not a magician either, Stuart.
Yeah.
No, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know one trick, that makes you a magician. That's not a magician. One trick's not a magician.
It is.
All right, so that's Larry David berating and belittling a young magician. I think it's his wife's nephew in that sketch from Curb Your Enthusiasm. So, and it sort of does sort of set up one of the things we're going to talk about now, too, is the whole question of whether knowing how a trick works and maybe even how our brain works while we're watching a magic trick interferes with our enjoyment of magic and interferes with some of the wonder that we were talking about before. So, yes, you want to jump in right now. Okay.
No, well, I can share with that briefly, and I'd love to hear your other guests. But at a magic convention in Buffalo, I was delighted to be in the presence of a couple of great magicians. And one of them was talking about how the other magicians, he knew how his trick was done. Mm. He can float a table across the stage without touching it. It just in not with wires and all this kind of big stage stuff. And he says, it's all beautiful. His levitation work, a guy named Losander. And I know exactly how it's done. And I don't care because it's so beautiful to watch. And I went back and told Losander this. And he got at first concerned that he was being commented on. But he really accepted that gift because the trick wasn't popped when you knew how it was done because it was a beautiful – it wasn't a trick.
You know, Lawrence Haas, there are two schools of thought about this. We're going to add our neuroscientist to the conversation in just a second. But it seems to me, just talking to magicians, and it's not something I do a lot, but there seem to be kind of two schools of thought, too, about how you approach the presentation of magic, at least in terms of this. One group of magicians are basically inviting you to think magically with them and sort of saying, we're in a world of magic. Things are going to happen that you'll never understand. They may even insist or allude occasionally to actual magical explanations for what's going on stage. There's another group of magicians who kind of insist, and I think Penn and Teller really kind of maybe are leaders in this category, insist on acknowledging at all times, this is a trick. This is a deception. There's an explanation for what we're doing. We're not going to tell you what that explanation is, but we're also not going to try to fool you into thinking that something truly magical, something truly supernatural is happening here. We're not even going to see that as a convention or a trope. First of all, am I right about this? Are there, in fact, two schools of thought like that?
If I may jump in,
yeah.
I actually would add a third school,
okay,
which is not between, everything's a trick or come away with us to a magical world, but rather enter into a space of theatrical make-believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to choose. You can, the audience understands that they're seeing a play when they go see Shakespeare. And the same thing can be true with magic in a theatrical space. Enter into this world of make-believe, don't believe.
All right, we're going to add to this conversation, as I say, two scientists who've really tried to look at not exactly what happens on stage, but what happens in our brains while we're watching all this. But that involves understanding what's happening on stage. You have to know what the magician is doing in order to fool the brain. So, and I hope I'm saying your names right, Dr. Stephen Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde. First of all, how did I do with pronunciation before we go any further?
Reasonably
well. All right. They are neuroscientists at the Barrow Neurological Institute and are the co-authors of Sleights of Mind. So in whatever order the two of you want to work this out in, explain what it is that your research is all about. You really are kind of trying to figure out how magic works in relation to how our brains work.
Well, it turns out that magic and neuroscience, even though at first sight you might think are two very different fields, we have a lot of interests in common, and we both have been trying to get at issues of perception, magicians, and neuroscientists. We as neuroscientists following the scientific method, but magicians have also been doing informal research for centuries, if not millennia, trying to understand how human perception and cognition work. So there are a lot of ways in which we can potentially help each other out in our respective goals.
Dr. Stephen Macnick, that then involves understanding what's happening. In other words, we're just sitting here watching magic being performed for us. We don't know what's happening. But to some degree or other, our brains have to be colluding a little bit with a magician. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, I mean, it comes down to the way that our brain processes different types of cognitive and perceptual information. Essentially, if, for example, if we could multitask, then many magic tricks, perhaps most of them, wouldn't work at all because we'd be able to pay attention to more than one thing at a time. And so the way that magicians actually perform the trick that requires you to pay attention here while they do something somewhere else, you just pay attention to both places and the trick wouldn't work. And as it turns out, that magicians are better at manipulating attention, for example, in this way than scientists are because, as Susanna said, that they've been doing it for so much longer and they've been doing systematic analyses of how the brain works for so much longer. Even though they don't put it in those terms and they're not using the scientific method, it's still a systematic analysis done by smart people who are thinking hard about human behavior, and they've hit on a lot of important things that science hasn't hit on yet. And so we realize that, yes, what they're looking at is how the brain is actually working, and we can take advantage of that to find out what they know and take decades off the research in cognitive neuroscience by doing so.
So Cyril the Sorcerer, I mean, I have magicians here with me today. I have one sitting in studio. First of all, does this ring true, what they're saying? Does that ring true for you?
It does, but I have to admit that I attended one of their lectures at a convention, and I enjoyed that. But I think it's one of the things I'm learning. I'm relatively new to the world of magic, and so many things that magicians who've been doing magic for decades just know automatically, I'm having to learn. And it's helpful to learn from folks like Larry, who is a performer and a philosopher, as well as neuroscientists who think about it and say, yes, technically, scientifically, that'll work. My father was an engineer, so I'm having to actually step sideways into the world of performance because I used to live in the world of science.
Well, let me ask you this in a different way. Okay, so before the show started, Wolfie was in here taking your picture, and you were just amusing us with a trick that involved an apparent levitation of a kind of squashed plastic bottle. I'm not asking you to tell me how you did that trick, but it did look like the thing was levitating. Now, from your point of view, is that just sort of, are you doing everything to make that happen? Or in the way that Dr. Stephen Macnick was just sort of saying, because my brain could only sort of look at this thing a certain way, and I couldn't really sort of multitask and kind of see everything that was going on, was my brain helping you in some way? Do you think at all about sort of how the observer basically helps you out?
Indeed. I thought about it. But only a little bit, because the first time I ever saw an effect done like that, not with a bottle. I do it with a bottle because I recycle. But I saw it with actually your previous caller, Daniel Greenwolf, performed that with a thing called the Wicker Man, and he levitated a Wicker Man. And I got goosebumps on the back of my neck. The hair was rising up. There were no trapeze, no wires, no magnets. He was just standing in a room doing this. And I was freaking out, but in the most wonderful way, not a scary way. And so I knew from that experience that if I basically use the same practices that he and other magicians have used using this principle, that hopefully you and Kion would go, oh, and you would enjoy that, and it would give you that little tingly sensation that we rarely get this day and age.
You know, Dr. Stephen Macnick and Dr. Susanna Martinez-Conde, in order to do the research that you're doing, at a certain point, you had to get magicians to cooperate with you, which means you sort of had to get them to do the thing that they really don't like to do, right? Which is tell you how they do stuff. So, first of all, were you able to do that? Were you able to get magicians to say, yes, this is how I do this, so that you guys could then sort of study how the brain works?
We were not even aware of that there was this a pact of secrecy among magicians until we were pretty advanced in our collaborations with magicians and our investigations of magic. We were fortunate in that the very first magicians that we started to work with were magicians that were very curious about not only how magic works in the minds of the spectators, but about the neural underpinnings. So they were very enthusiastic about contributing their knowledge towards advancing the science.
I mean, Dr. Stephen Macnick, too, it seems to me that the more that they you want to learn from them, but also the more that they learn from you, conceivably, the better that they could get at magic, the more that they know the neuroscience of this.
Yeah, it's a two-edged sword. So we, you know, on the one hand, we really wanted to, and our main goal is to advance science. So we wanted to learn what magicians know about the brain so that we could basically cut time off the research and figure out what had been discovered and find out what things that they might know that we could have focused hypotheses to test in the laboratory. But at the same time, what they wanted, and Teller, for example, was very specific about wanting, was that he had questions about how specific tricks worked that he and Ten do, and he didn't know why they worked, but he had his own suspicions and his own pet theories, as do most magicians who invent tricks. They have their own kind of models or theories about how the mind is working. And what we discovered, Susanna and I, in working with these magicians, is that some of the ideas that these master magicians had about how the brain works were definitely wrong. They'd already been disproven. It wasn't that. But some of them were right, which we thought was really interesting, because they didn't come to those conclusions through reading about it in science. They came to those conclusions by learning it through magic books, and from their own informal experimentation with audiences. And at the same time, some of the things that they learned were actually new. That is, we realized that they discovered new things that science didn't know and that we needed to test, because those were extremely important. And in the process of doing this, Teller, for example, asked us to do specific experiments on specific effects that they studied to try and use scientific method to determine what the underlying cause was. And so we actually did that, and we published a paper.
So, I mean, I think for a lot of us, and this probably reveals a way in which I've ghettoized magic, my assumption is that all magicians ever really are thinking about is getting you to pay attention to one thing instead of another. And really what you're suggesting to me is this is a much more granulated, much more sophisticated, nuanced set of ideas that they're having about human cognition.
Yes, I think that misdirection isn't necessarily about attending to one part of space while directing your attention away from another part of space. You can have internal dialogues, there are memory effects, there are effects that reverse causal order between cause and effect of A and B. So it's not all about attention, and it's not all even about spatially positioning attention in your visual field in a certain place. There's also other sensory systems involved. There's attending to specific features of the world and specific objects rather than specific points in space. So it is much more complex, and certainly the master magicians that we worked with, including Larry Haas, are well aware of this.
All right. So, Lev Grossman, you're sitting there. Of course, you write fantasy about magicians. You're also a book critic. You may be wanting eagerly to read Sleights of Mind, which is their book about all this stuff. But there must be another part of you that's a little concerned about it's kind of bleeding the mystery out of everything. In other words, I mean, the more that science understands all this stuff and can compartmentalize it and assign numerical values to it, the less that world that you're so attracted to exists, correct?
Oh. Well, I suppose that's true. I have the luxury of operating in a fictional world where science does exactly what I tell it to. There's certainly, when you're writing about magic, when you're creating fictional magic, you are performing a kind of burlesque act. You show the reader a certain amount. I think lately, writers tend to show them more and more. Magic has been somewhat domesticated to the point where it's something that it's a craft that can be taught to children in a classroom. You didn't see Gandalf going to magic school. He just did what he did. But now you have Harry Potter who goes to school. He learns it there. But you don't show that last increment. You don't explain absolutely everything. Suddenly magic becomes denatured into science if you do that. You leave just one little dark sector, which allows everything to feel mysterious and magical.
Oh, and that kind of duality, I would just say, we're going to have to wrap up this segment here, and I want to thank everybody else, and we're going to continue with our conversation, bring everybody back. But, you know, within the world that you write about, Lev, it's kind of interesting the way that dualism also exists inside there, to the extent, anyway, that everybody in your books, all the main characters in your books, have gone to this school called Breakbills, where they learn, once again, canonical magic. They're learning how to make actual, similar to Hogwarts, except that one character, Julia, didn't go. She didn't get in, and she learned magic on her own. And there's this sense in the books that Julia knows things, that just in the same way that in our world, magic represents a whole bunch of stuff that lies outside the canon, you know, whether it's alchemy or, you know, something like that. Within the world of your books, the person who didn't go to the school, who didn't learn the structured knowledge, somehow or other knows a whole bunch of stuff that's intensely useful and very profound that the canonical magicians don't know.
I think one reason magic will always be with us is that it is by definition that thing that we do not know. However far we push back the boundaries, we know all about physics, we push it down to the level of the atom, we push it out to the edge of the universe, whatever it is that sits just beyond that edge of what we can know, that is magic, and it'll never go away.
All right, we're going to go grab a quick break here. We'll be back after this. Everyone amazed, the audience erupts, he's cheered and he is praised. Oh, the magician's bending, another show is ending. The crowds, they gasp in awe, the magician's such a draw.
Today's show was produced by Hermione Kaplan and me. Our executive producer is the great Talarski, and Gregory the Magnificent appeared in the intro and handles our Twitter feed at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Mandrake the Magician. For stories, show pages, photos, and videos of the Faith Middleton show staff performing the classic floating sweaty ball trick, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, performances and conversations about the healing power of music. And now, back to Colin.
I really don't want to see them perform that trick. All right, so if I introduce everybody, the show will be over. So I'm not going to exactly tell you who's here, but we'll sort of allude to that as we go along. But right here in the studio, okay, I'm now about to kind of reverse the polarity of everything that I've talked about so far, or every argument that I've made so far, because there's sort of another way of looking at this, and Cyril the Sorcerer, also known as C.J. May, in the studio with me, is the embodiment of it. Okay, so in some ways we think about magic as the thing that either rejects whatever is sort of scientifically accepted, or as Lev just suggested, you know, represents like a whole sector of things that kind of lies outside structured understanding. But you're kind of doing the opposite right now. We have an environment in which science tells us quite a bit about what we need to do to live more sustainably. Science tells us quite a bit about what kind of danger we're in from things like climate change, problems we've actually caused. And you're actually using magic to try to educate people about that in an environment where really there's like a whole other sector of people who are rejecting scientific knowledge, not exactly to embrace magic or fun or fantasy or anything like that, but just because they don't feel like accepting science. So explain what it is that you do. How are you using magic to teach these lessons?
I use performance magic to teach people about environmental issues. And this started when a local magician, a guy named Jim Sisti, I was over his house. We were friends, and he was teaching me a little bit of magic. This is 8 years ago. And he said, well, what do you do? And I said, I work at Yale. He said, oh, you professor? No, I run the recycling program. And then he got this wonderful Dumbledore-like twinkle in his eye. He walked over to his coffee table, and he picked up some ripped-up pieces of newspaper. He put them piece by piece into his hand, and then boom. With one shake, it was a new newspaper all over again. And I was floored on two levels. One was it was just a beautiful trick. Mm-hmm. Two is that this said, what a wonderful thing to use in terms of teaching people about the magic of recycling. I could describe the recycling facility and the trucks and all the machinery to a bunch of children, and they might get bored and want to leave. Mm. But if I can show them that by putting their paper, ripped up as it may be, into a recycling bin, they can turn that old paper, boom, into new, then I'm in a sense empowering them that they indeed have a form of magic.
So in a way, I mean, one of the reasons I suppose that we could say that people don't necessarily take environmentalism as seriously as they could, or don't embrace things like recycling, don't do things that would actually sort of help their own environment be better, is it doesn't seem like it would be any fun, right? It seems like a lot of drudgery. Thinking about climate change is really terrifying, so people tend not to want to do it. So you're suggesting basically that you could make it fun.
And indeed, I try to make people understand that they have, well, in the climate change, for instance, I did a show for the Peabody Museum as a part of their exhibit. And I taught people that they could save energy, save money, and help they save the planet. And I did this in 15 minutes, talking about energy conservation, choosing energy, all sorts of things that people can do. And I think environmentalism can scare people because they think, oh, it's the environment. It's so big. It's out of my control. But magic is all about things being in our control. And we have that crossover when it comes to turning off your lights, getting solar panels on your roof. We can use magic to convey those messages in a way that are enticing and exciting for people so they realize they can do magic every day.
He's going to do a magic trick right here at the end. But before we do that, Lawrence Haas, just to sort of wrap this thing up too. I mean, it kind of goes back to the whole long conversation we've been having here. As I now hear it, I hear it differently. That in a way, magic is an art that can be put at the service of almost anything. You know, we think about Robert Houdin, you know, the sort of the original art magician of the 19th century who was brought in by the French government to intimidate Algerian rebels by, you know, catching a bullet in his teeth and stuff like that. And they had their own quote-unquote magic tradition, and they looked at that and said, wow, his magic is stronger than ours. I suppose that can be classified as magic being put, you know, at the service of colonialism or something pretty bad. But magic can be anything, right?
Yes. Well, right earlier in the show, I said that magic is, you know, the art of impossibility. But at the same time, it reminds audiences that that what they thought was impossible just might be possible.
All right.
And I think that's why CJ gets these reactions with his work. It re-empowers people to think about the magic they can make in relation to the environment.
All right. I'm going to give him the last 60 seconds or so to do a magic trick, an audible magic trick here on the radio.
Well, I'm going to need everybody's help, Lev, Larry, our scientists. I'm holding Edison's incandescent light bulb. It was magical. It changed the world. But really, it's wasteful. It uses too much energy. It creates too much heat. And so we need to say goodbye to that bulb, just as the way we're going to say goodbye to Colin and our listeners today. So I'm hoping that all of you, and you guys at home, can help me cast one last spell. We're going to say goodbye in the count of three, and then we're going to see what happens to the bulb. Or I should say, you're going to hear what what happens to the bulb. I'm not holding the bulb. I'm holding it in a bag, so my hands aren't touching the bulb. So on the count of three, please help me say goodbye to an old and out-of-date piece of magic. One, two, three.
Goodbye.
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 Okay. He just sort of looked at it, and the light bulb smashed inside a plastic bag. And Wolfie was photographing him, so we'll see if we did a special trick that we can catch him at. All right, this has been great, and it's so much fun to talk to all of you. So thanks once again to Lev Grossman, the Magician King, the Magicians, and I am so ready, Lev, for the Magician's Land. When is that coming out?
That's August 5th, I think.
All right, I have something to live for then. Cyril the Sorcerer, also known as CJ May, Dr. Lawrence Haas, our scientist as well. We'll be back tomorrow with a show about the power of healing contained in music. And once again, backed up by a certain amount of neuroscience.
I, the great Wolfengrim, will now attempt the most difficult illusion of my career. This show will end in 3, 2, 1. Did it work? I don't think it worked.